ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Get ready to kick off the week with another jam-packed episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. This week, Ray Mahlaka joins us online to help us process some of the biggest headlines of this past week. Here's what's coming your way. Shell is gone. What the oil giant's exit from South Africa really means. Then a burning flag sends some South Africans into a fiery rage.
I would love to have been the fly on the wall in the room whereby this ad was produced. And I just wonder what kind of quality checks were followed here. What kind of debates were had when this advert was produced?
Later, Israel ups the ante as ground forces intensify their presence in Gaza. And could it soon be lights off for Joburg? Perhaps if Eskom gets its way. But first, several construction workers remain trapped beneath the rubble after a five-story apartment building in George in the Western Cape collapsed last week. While it's too early to determine the cause, South Africans want answers.
Welcome back, Ray. It's so great having you with us. How are you doing?
All good, thanks, Lazan. You know, I'm thinking about the countdown to the general election. We have about, 19 odd days left? And there's so much madness around the election.
Definitely. But I want us to focus on a few other things this week, because obviously there's been a lot of focus on elections in the last couple of weeks on our show, on Daily Maverick. And I want us to start with the developing story that's been absolutely devastating to follow, and that's the building collapse in George. And of course, the grueling rescue operations that have continued nonstop for the past week. What a horrific story. I really honestly don't know yet what to make of it.
Yeah, me too. But I think the nation wants answers here. How did this tragedy and disaster happen? Is it a result of poor workmanship at the site, the construction site in George? The families also want answers for those construction workers who sadly passed away.
And the Western Cape government has since set up a forensic engineering team to really try and determine what led to the collapse, because there are a lot of theories floating around already. And we'll obviously see what comes from those investigations. Of course, listeners can find all the latest updates on Daily Maverick's website. I understand Marian Tum has done some amazing coverage on this, from examining the actual site to the building projects and the papers that were filed and looking into the various developers involved. So really great coverage on Daily Maverick with regards to this story.
Shell is calling it quits on South Africa. In a statement on the 6th of May, the oil and gas giant announced it had decided to, quote, reshape the downstream portfolio and intends to divest its shareholding in Shell Downstream South Africa. A lot of big words that's left many of us scratching our heads about what it all actually means. Fortunately, Ray has all the info to help us wrap our heads around it.
Now, moving on to another story that's left some quite shocked. Obviously, industry insiders are saying, well, we've been seeing this coming for the last decade at least. But a lot of alarming headlines started circulating last week when Shell announced it will be exiting the South African market. Now, many political parties immediately, of course, latched onto this. But there's clearly a lot of confusion around this. First off, can you explain to us what this exit actually means? Are they pulling out of SA entirely, or is it simply their corporate presence that will be gone? What is happening?
So 5 years ago, Shell began reviewing its operations and businesses in South Africa. So there are two components to Shell's operations in South Africa. One is known as downstream business, which includes service stations, so garages that are branded by Shell. And Shell has about more than 600 service or garage stations countrywide in South Africa. So that is the downstream business. The other side of Shell's operations is called the upstream business, which includes the exploration and extracting of crude oil and natural gas and natural gas liquids. So that is the upstream business. Shell, 5 years ago, reviewed its operations in South Africa and came to the conclusion that it aims to dispose or sell what it calls its non-core retail business, which is the downstream business. So we're talking about those service or petrol stations. And Shell has really undertaken this review because of several factors. One of them is that, yes, South Africa's operating and investment climate is becoming difficult for many investors because the economy is weak. But also we know that globally, oil is not a popular resource because of the move to renewable energy and cleaner resources. So a lot of oil companies are getting a lot of flack for continuing with oil operations at a time when there are environmental concerns around oil. So Shell is really trying to move on to cleaner energy and away from oil. So a result of that exercise, Lazan, is that now Shell does not completely aim to exit South Africa, but it plans to dispose what it calls non-core retail businesses, the downstream business operations that I referred to, which are mainly those 600 service or petrol stations countrywide.
So what are the possible implications of this on South Africa? I mean, there's specifically a lot of concern around employment. Will we see mass job losses, or are there plans in place to keep the various Shell petrol stations open, maybe under a different name?
The situation is unclear at this point, but there is a worst case and best case scenario here. The worst case scenario is when Shell sells those petrol stations, there might be job losses. That's the reality, and that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, which I think will likely happen here, is that another oil and chemicals company will step in to buy the petrol stations that are operated by Shell currently. There is the infrastructure that's already there. It's available for someone else to take over and keep that infrastructure going. In the rumor mill, it is rumored that Sasol might be another competitor that might step in to buy these operations and keep them going to prevent job losses. So the situation remains fluid at this point. We are uncertain about what will happen in the future, but those are the best and worst case scenarios.
Now, Shell isn't the only major international company looking to jump ship. We also heard of ArcelorMittal SA's intentions to possibly close its steel operations in South Africa, and that's also been kind of brewing for a while. Now, several factors play into their decisions, the biggest being union disputes with regards to wage increases. And basically, the steel company is saying we just can't continue upping wages. It doesn't make sense and we can't afford it. So what's the outlook regarding that, considering it could lead to thousands of jobs being lost?
Yeah, I mean, up to 3,500 jobs might be lost here. So I had the privilege of recently visiting ArcelorMittal's steel operations in Vereeniging, in Gauteng. You know, the situation with ArcelorMittal also is about Africa's economy. So South Africa's economy over the past 5 years has really, and 10 years, let's go back to 10 years, in fact. South Africa's economy has been weak. The government is not really embarking on large-scale construction or infrastructure projects. The private sector as well is scaling back on construction projects. When those construction projects don't happen, it means that the demand for steel slows down because steel is used largely in construction projects. So because of that economic decline, the demand for steel has really taken a knock in South Africa. And this is why ArcelorMittal is now embarking on a process to also review its steel operations. It might shut down its steel manufacturing factories in Thunderbale Park in Gauteng and Newcastle in KZN. There has been an outcry because the decision to shut down those operations might lead to more than 3,500 jobs. So ArcelorMittal is now in the process of consulting with government, consulting with labor and trade unions about finding a solution to keep these operations going and averting the worst case scenario of shutting them down. So it has deferred the decision to close those plants for another 6 months. So a final decision on the life of those steel operations will be decided in August. But for now, the situation remains precarious. It's not really looking good for ArcelorMittal.
The campaign trail is on fire, certainly in more ways than one. This past week, the DA left many South Africans hot under the collar as the official opposition party posted a controversial elections ad showcasing an albeit fake South African flag slowly burning to ashes. As the SABC refuses to air the ad unless the imagery is changed and the ANC calls it treasonous and despicable, the DA stands by its divisive ad.
I want to move on to another story that's really caused a firestorm, and apologies for the pun, but I mean, who knew a CGI flag burning could lead to such drama? And it seems the DA didn't know, because they were seemingly caught by surprise when South Africans lashed out following a recent ad showcasing a burning South African flag. Now, some say this is an aggressive attack on the people of South Africa, emphasizing that flag burning is deemed a criminal act in many countries. Others are saying this is just a storm in a teacup. Move on, nothing to see here. So what's your take on this matter?
You know, I would love to have been the fly on the wall in the room whereby this ad was produced. And I just wonder what kind of quality checks were followed here. What kind of debates were had when this advert was produced? Did the DA anticipate that this would inspire intense emotions? Well, if that was the goal, it succeeded.
Yes.
You know, but I think a much bigger question might be why this advert was published in the first place and whether it will succeed in winning more votes for the DA. But, you know, a lot of important questions were asked. Some people said the flames in the flag represented the problems causing South Africa to burn. Other people said, imagine if the EFF was the one to burn the South African flag. Would it have, you know, inspired this kind of outrage? I really would want to understand what the DA was thinking behind this idea. We now see that the SABC won't even flaunt the ad on its television platforms. I just wonder if this matter really provokes important questions as to why would someone want to do this and whether this ad was generated to achieve political gain as well. So I'm quite conflicted about this matter, hence why I'm asking these questions.
Yes, no, exactly, because we've seen several political figures, including President Cyril Ramaphosa, coming forward and strongly condemning this stunt, so to speak, and calling it treasonous. And obviously, in response, the DA's John Steenhuisen defended the ad, saying, you know, Ramaphosa is the last person to preach to us about treason. Meanwhile, the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture, Zizi Kodwa, is also planning to take further action against the DA. But for me, my biggest question is, either way, you know, it's giving the DA loads of publicity, and it makes me question. I think they were fully aware of what they were doing, and they just took the stance of there's no such thing as bad publicity in South African politics. As long as we're topping the list of conversations, then we're winning at this campaign game. And that's my take on it.
And I'm inclined to agree with it, Liz, because you've got so many political parties right now in South Africa vying for the attention of voters, vying for airtime when the attention span of voters is so short and a lot demands of that attention.
Over the weekend, the Israeli military ordered the evacuation of central Rafah in the south of Gaza.
considered to be the last refuge for over 1 million residents, the Israel Defense Forces has been rapidly expanding its military operations in the city as it continues to target alleged Hamas hideouts. By Friday, about 80,000 citizens had evacuated the area. That number quickly rose to at least 150,000 by Sunday as Gazans made their way towards what Israel is calling the safe zone. Meanwhile, the South African government has once again approached the International Court of Justice to order Israel to withdraw from the city and allow the free movement of humanitarian aid. Now, on to international news, and this is a story, it's sort of faded from the headlines in recent weeks, and that's the growing humanitarian crisis unfolding in Palestine. But the actions by Israel recently turned the spotlight back onto Gaza, and more specifically Rafah, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu firstly said, "We're moving into Rafah, the last sliver of safety for the Palestinian people." But then he also doubled down by also banning a major international news broadcaster, Al Jazeera, from operating and reporting in Israel. Some have said this is another attempt by the Israeli government to really conceal, quote, its brutality. And others have questioned how a ban like this is actually possible in a supposed democratic country. What are your views on what's happening at the moment?
And there was also talks of a ceasefire, but the Israeli government's message was quite clear that there will be no permanent ceasefire and the devastating war on Gaza will continue. Now, this is quite sad. And again, this is a humanitarian crisis. And in talking about this issue, we should never forget the number of people who have been displaced, the number of deaths that have come out of this war. I mean, an estimated 80,000 Palestinians have fled Rafah, and thousands more are apparently attempting to leave as this war continues. So when might a ceasefire happen? You know, Lazan, it's anybody's guess at this point, but it doesn't seem to look good at this point.
Yeah, no, I don't see that happening either. Just going off of Netanyahu's most recent comments in response to US President Joe Biden saying, we're going to withdraw all weapons support if you choose to continue with a ground offense in Rafah. I mean, Netanyahu essentially said, so what? I don't care. Yeah. You do whatever you want. But my main concern, as you've also pointed out, is there's about 1 million people sheltering in Rafah, and there's really nowhere else to go at the moment. I mean, where do these people go? How do you move 1 million people? It is just unthinkable.
It's unthinkable. It's unconceivable. It is inhumane as well, too, because even as you move those people, how do you get aid to people? How do you get medical supplies? Food, water, the basics of human survival. And we know that that for sure is not guaranteed at all. And if aid does come through, it often does not get to where the need is. So there's so many layers to this complex and really violent issue.
Pay up or else. That's the warning given by Eskom to the city of Joburg after it dragged city officials to court for unpaid debt amounting to 1.1 billion rands. But Johannesburg's City Power is saying not so fast. Now, an all-out legal battle is set to unfold as both sides fight for their billions. Back to local matters, and Eskom is threatening to cut supply to South Africa's business hub, Joburg. According to Eskom, the city owes the power utility about 1.1 billion rands in outstanding fees. But the city of Joburg is fighting back, saying, listen, Eskom, you owe us 3.4 billion in overcharges. So the matter is now going to the High Court as Eskom pushes for a court order compelling the city of Joburg to pay its bills. And the first thing that came to my mind is imagine Joburg going dark indefinitely as a result of this. I mean, do you see this actually happening? Do you see Eskom going through with its threat? Because it's done it in other municipalities.
Well, I mean, Joburg is going dark for other reasons, you know, already past supply in the city. It's not so reliable. As a fellow Joburger who often experiences power cuts that are outside of the load shedding schedule, the city is going dark. But this is quite an interesting story, Lazan. So This started with Andre de Ruyter when he was appointed as the CEO of Eskom many, many years ago. With Andre de Ruyter's leadership, he has really intensified the collection of municipal debt. And since Andre de Ruyter's appointment, he has been taking municipalities to court. He has been enforcing recovery efforts against municipalities. And with Andre de Ruyter leaving, it seems like that culture at Eskom on enforcing arrear debt from municipalities and recovering that debt is continuing. What we know from Eskom is that municipalities owe Eskom 70 billion rand, 70 billion rand in unpaid electricity debt. The offending municipalities are largely in the Free State. They are in Mpumalanga and they are in Gauteng. And apparently the city of Joburg, through City Power, has been defaulting on municipal payments for electricity since October last year. Mm-hmm. So how does this debt grow to 1 billion rand or so from a few months ago? So we are really seeing a much more invigorated Eskom that has more energy in recovering this outstanding money. Because just imagine, 70 billion rand that is owed by municipalities, if that money is recovered, it would really go far in fixing Eskom's financial situation, right?
No, absolutely. And it makes complete sense why they're fighting so hard. I mean, they've done a similar thing in Tshwane as well, just really pushing hard to get the municipality there to also pay back what is owed to Eskom. And that's also resulted in some really dramatic fallouts between the various role players. But the matter will be heard before the Gauteng High Court on the 4th of June. The matter, of course, between the city of Joburg and Eskom. And we will, of course, be following the case closely. Now, I want to wrap up today's show just by going back to the George building disaster. And I just want to take a moment to commend the individuals who have worked tirelessly to pull construction workers from the rubble. I mean, we've been watching the live coverage hour upon hour, just seeing them on site, just working endless hours to try and get to the remaining construction workers.
Yeah, and those are our heroes, you know, Lazan and the community of George as well. In speaking to media and helping us piece this puzzle that is so unclear and helping to fill the gaps of how this tragedy unfolded.
And then just to encourage our listeners to really go check out a lovely piece written by Tamsin Mettlerkamp on Daily Maverick on the dedicated canine unit, which is also assisting in efforts. You can find it now on the Daily Maverick website. It's a lovely piece. It brings a slightly different perspective to this story. And as devastating as it is, it's also very heartwarming to see how people just come together. But yeah, that's all we have time for this week, Ray. Thanks so much for spending time with us. It's been wonderful as always, and I'm wishing you a happy and healthy week ahead.
Thank you so much, Lazan. Always fun.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.